So our favorite topic to think about is ourselves and what happens to us, what I feel, what I think, what people think about me, what makes me happy, what makes me miserable, how I'm going to be tomorrow, how I'm going to be in 10 years, what I was yesterday, what happened to me 15, 20 years ago. So the field of what we think about most of the time is quite narrow when you consider that there's over 7 billion human beings on this planet. And this, the way that we focus on ourselves is quite unhealthy because it involves a lot of worry, anxiety that are all unnecessary. That attachment and anxiety lead us to get angry. Then we think anger is going to help us and get other people to do what we want them to do, but it usually doesn't. It usually creates more problems for us. So we're really in a stew because we want to be happy. But the way we focus on ourselves and the results of this unhealthy way of focusing on ourselves actually creates more problems for us. So this is why the Buddha asked us to really examine if our self-centered thought is our friend or if it's our enemy. And if we find that it's like a thief that steals our happiness and deceives us, then we shouldn't kick it out of the house so it stops doing that. So instead of cuddling our self-centered thought and poor me, you know, this kind of way of thinking, to really stand up to that thief that pretends to be our friend but actually makes a bigger mess in our life. So even though this is the way to be happy, still we're kind of afraid of doing it, and it takes great courage to actually stand up to the self-centered thought. It is far easier to blame other people for our problems. But if we really contemplate the faults of the self-centered thought again and again, that increases our determination to overcome it, to kick the thief out of the house instead of inviting it for tea and biscuits. And so this kind of determination let us practice the Buddha's teachings with the aim to attain the highest awakening, so that we can become the servants of other living beings instead of the servants of the thieves, like the self-centered thought. So with this kind of motivation, let's listen to the teachings this evening. So it really does take a lot of courage. So our self-centered thought is so entrenched. It has so many good reasons why we should follow it. Yeah. And yet, all of those reasons are actually fictitious. And the more we follow our self-centered thought, the more we get in one jam after the other. Our biggest jam, just being in this situation of constantly getting reborn again and again and again. Yeah. Self-centeredness isn't the root cause of that, but it's certainly a big factor in making it happen. Yeah. So lots of times now, when we hear people talking, they're talking about embracing our suffering, embracing our anger, you know, the kind of psychology things in magazines. You know, we're supposed to embrace everything. And I think we have to understand what it is we're embracing and what embracing means. Yeah, because if we think, oh, I embrace, instead of fighting my anger, I embrace my anger. Yeah? Well, yeah, we don't want to get mad at ourselves for being angry. That doesn't solve our problem of anger. But embracing our anger and saying, oh, anger, you're so wonderful. You're so sweet. I'm not going to push you away. Yeah. And where does that lead us? Yeah. I don't think it leads someplace good. Yeah. So I think there's times we need to stand up to parts of ourselves, you know. Not in the way of hating ourselves, because hating ourselves is completely ridiculous. Yeah, doesn't do any good. It's just more affliction. But to stand up to the afflictions and the self-centered thought that really lead us in circles. So sometimes you read the thought training texts by the great masters, and they'll talk to the self-centered thought, and they'll say, you, you're the one who sent me to the lower realms, life after life. You're the one who gets me into so many relationship problems. You're the one who, you know, does this and that. Yeah. And so there's even a thought training phrase, put all the blame onto one. Yeah, so you put all the blame onto the self-centered thought. Yeah. So that doesn't mean hating ourselves, because we realize that we and our self-centered thought are not the same thing. They're two separate things. Okay, so we stand up to the self-centered thought. Yeah, tell it off. If you really want to tell somebody off, tell your self-centered thought off. Not yourself, because you're not the self-centered thought. But identify that thief and say, get out of here. Yeah, you're making me miserable. I'm tired of serving you Venerable Yeshe's chocolate chip cookies. You got to get out of here because you're making a mess in my life. Okay. So tonight we're in the section of the Gomchen Lamrim that is talking about the Bodhisattva practices. And so facing the self-centered thought is one of the major practices in that Bodhisattvas do. And you have to do it even before you become a Bodhisattva. And completely eliminate the self-centered thought in order to become a Buddha. Yeah, you don't find self-centered Buddhas. Okay? You don't find Buddhas who were worried about what other people think about them and, you know, how much they're going to collect for Social Security. And, you know, Buddhas just are not involved in that kind of thing. Yeah, the self-centered thought is long gone. And so they're really free. They're really free. Because if you think about it, you know, all this twirling around ourselves again and again and again, hey, what's happening to me, what this person did to me, and what's going on in my life, and what's going to happen to me. And it's exhausting. We consume so much of our life energy, you know, spinning around something that doesn't lead us in a profitable direction. Yeah, so when we're able to just put the self-centered thought aside, there's so much more vibrancy in our lives and so much more energy to do many more things. Plus, we're a whole lot happier. Yeah. Because what makes us upset when other people criticize us? Yeah, it's not love and compassion that make us upset when other people criticize us. Yeah. Yeah, self-centered thought. So if we're able to let go of that self-centered thought, then people can criticize us all they want. And our mind is like a very still pond. Wouldn't that be nice? Wouldn't that be nice? Okay, so in talking about the Bodhisattva practices, there's six primary ones, and we've discussed the first two, generosity and ethical conduct. And so this evening we're talking about fortitude. Okay, so fortitude. Let me give you the definition here of it. Yeah. It's often translated as patience, but I don't think patience, I don't like that as a translation, because patience makes me think of waiting for somebody. You know, I'm agitated, just be patient, wait. It'll get resolved. Whereas fortitude, for me, invokes the idea of inner strength. Yeah? Things around me can be totally chaotic, but I'm able to remain firm. Yeah? I don't crumble. I think an important quality to have in this world. Okay, so the definition of fortitude is an undisturbed mind that can bear harm inflicted by others, suffering, such as illness, so on, and difficulties that we encounter to practice. Okay? So it can bear harm, suffering, difficulties, and it doesn't bear them by gritting its teeth. You know, with fortitude, we don't grit our teeth and say, I'm going to be a man and bear this. You know, that's not what we do inside. Yeah, it isn't that kind of bearing. It's, you know, we can accept things and remain firm and clear and steady without being like a feather blown around in the wind, you know, moved by everything that happens to us or every word that somebody says to us. Okay, so there's three kinds of fortitude, three types that they talk about. The first is the fortitude of non-retaliation. Okay, so this is very un-American. Yeah, the fortitude of non-retaliation. It means that when other people harm you, you don't retaliate. So this goes on a personal level, a group level, an international level. Okay? So it's the fortitude of being able to bear harm without retaliating. Now think about that. How many of us from the time we were this big were taught when somebody harms us, we should harm them back? Yeah? Isn't that what we were usually taught as kids? Somebody harmed you, you harm them back. You're entitled to it. It's your right. Yeah? And this fortitude says, you know, when somebody harms you, there's a whole lot of other things you can do besides retaliate. And if you're able to control your anger, because it's anger that makes us retaliate, then you can be really creative in how you respond to things so that things turn out better for everybody in the long term. Because you know how it is when, you know, someone harms us, we retaliate. What usually happens after that? Yeah, then they come back and fight us. Yeah. And then, of course, they harmed us again. So we slug them harder. And they come and slug us harder. And then, you know, you have a free-for-all. So the Buddha was very clear that hatred, anger, they're not overcome by more hatred and anger, yeah, but only by love, only by compassion, only by understanding. But as Americans, we say, love, compassion. That means roll over on your belly and capitulate. And they're going to take more advantage of you than before. Yeah? Isn't that kind of inbred in our culture, you know? You got to pick yourself up by your own bootstraps. How in the world do you do that? Yeah? How do you pick yourself up by your own bootstraps? I've tried it, holding on to my shoes. And trying to pick myself up, it doesn't work. Yeah? So, you know, this thing of retaliate, get your revenge, stand up for yourself against the enemy. You know, I'm a bit skeptical because that hasn't worked very well in my life when I've done that. The solution to retaliation and anger is not that you stuff your anger and you pretend everything's fine and you just smile, you know, and you're so full of forgiveness. So your husband beats you, you know, and, oh dear, really, I wish you didn't beat me. But, you know, you beat me last night and you beat me the night before. And the night before that. But I really forgive you. I have so much compassion for you, dear husband, who beats me. So I'm just going to, you know, go along with it. It's fine. I know you have some problems with your anger. I'll be patient. Is that wisdom? Yeah, that's stupidity, isn't it? So compassion does not mean that you're stupid in the face of harm. Yeah, you just sit there. Yeah, you want to walk all over me? Sure, you know, maybe wipe your feet before, but no, you know, you can protect yourself and you can intercede to stop the situation. but without being angry at the other person. Yeah. But rather understanding that person's suffering, what they're doing is making me suffer. Yeah, they're creating negative karma for their own future rebirth. Yeah, I'm miserable now. It's not really doing anybody any good. So compassion for everybody on, you know, on both sides of it, of the thing is much more called for. Yeah, compassion for this person who is harming me because they think harming me will release them from their own internal pain. Just as we think that retaliating to them will release us from our internal pain. It doesn't. Okay? So the solution to the anger isn't to stuff the anger and just become the world's doormat. Yeah, it's to look at the situation in a completely different way so that we aren't angry to start with. Yeah, because anger comes from the conceptual mind. Behind every episode of our anger, we're telling ourselves a story. And that story is usually, well, always exaggerated in one way or another. So when we're able to stop that exaggerated story and look at the situation more realistically, then there we often see that there's nothing to be angry at to start with. But this really involves some practice on our part, because I don't know about you, but I am so convinced that the stories I tell myself are 100% true, that trying to transform my mind into another way of looking at the situation at the beginning feels like I'm, you know, painting over something. Yeah, that I'm trying to convince myself of a wrong view, when actually I'm trying to train myself in a correct view. Okay, so it really needs some practice, because we can see so clearly when we're angry, our mind is very simple, yeah? Very simple, very clear. You harmed me, you're wrong, I'm right, solution is you change. Very simple, isn't it? That's the story we tell ourselves, I'm right. You're wrong, you change. Yeah. What does the other person say in response to that? They say, you got it wrong, buddy. I'm right, you're wrong, and you change. Okay. So that's really not going to get us anywhere. So it's very interesting to practice looking at situations in different ways, and in that way to release our anger. So the Buddha, you know, when he talked about ascetic practices, because at his time in ancient India, the wanderers, you know, practiced a lot of asceticism. I mean, some of them extreme asceticism. And even in India, if you go today, you see some of them practicing extreme asceticism. The Buddha said, yeah, the best ascetics, yeah, or the real asceticism is when somebody gets angry at you, that you don't get angry back at them. When somebody insults you or derides you, you don't insult and deride them back. When somebody points out your faults and criticizes you, you don't point out their faults and criticize them in return. And when somebody beats you physically, you don't beat them back. Yeah. It's the opposite of what most of us have been taught as kids, and the opposite of our national policy. Okay. But the Buddha says this is the real ascetic, the ascetic practice, the real practice of, you know, confronting the inner enemy. So again, it doesn't mean stuffing our emotions and pretending they're not there, because that doesn't work either. We still have them and they just come out in another way. It means seeing the situation in a completely different way. Okay? So criticism is I think, one of the big ones that we get revved up about when we perceive that somebody is criticizing us or pointing out our faults. Yeah. And our inner story usually runs something like, why are you criticizing me and pointing out my faults? You have them too. You should, you know, people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. Yeah. Anyway, I don't have any faults. You're just making them up and projecting your own internal stuff on me because you're bipolar and depressed and have personality disorder and what are some of the other ones? And you have oppositional defiance disorder, and you have ADD, and you have ADHD, and, you know, so we diagnose them, right? Yeah. Doesn't matter. We don't know what we're talking about. That never stopped us from issuing a psychological diagnosis. Yeah. So, you know, they have this problem. They're projecting their stuff on me. Yeah. It's unfair. Because I don't have that fault. And even if I did have that fault, you're not supposed to notice it. And even if you do notice it, you're supposed to tolerate it and realize that I'm doing my best. Yeah. You're not supposed to point my faults out. Yeah. Because anyway, I don't have them. But if I have them, you shouldn't point them out. And, you know, so we go round and around like this, okay? Yeah, so that's part of our inner story. Yeah. The other part, another part of our inner story is it's unfair. Yeah. I think this is, especially in the U.S., these are some of the first words kids learn. It's unfair. Yeah? But, yeah, when you have siblings, whether you have siblings or not, yeah, when you get in trouble, it's unfair. Jeannie Gordon's parents don't make her do that. Yeah? It's unfair. You don't have my brother do that. Yeah? So that's another one. We continue that one into adulthood, you know. We don't say it out loud too much because we're trying to not show others how mentally uncontrolled we are. Yeah. But inside we're saying it's unfair. Yeah. I'm me. I'm the wondrous one. Sweet, innocent. Always right, never do anything wrong. Why are these people criticizing me? They're just projecting their garbage on me. Okay. So, and we build up the story. And, you know, we ruminate, we go around the story again and again, you know, they did this to me, and then they said that, and then they said that, and then they did this. And we think about it again and again and again, you know? Yeah, do you do that? Yeah, ruminate, go around about it a lot. Sometimes, well, what did they really mean by that? You know, they said that sentence. What's the deep meaning? Yeah, I don't. There's something else going on behind that. Ruminate some more. We make ourselves very miserable that way. Very miserable. Yeah. But we're right and they're wrong. Okay? So we usually limit ourselves, because we're angry now, yeah, to two behaviors. There's some variety on this. One behavior is, get the out of here. Get rid of you. No, I'm not going to do that. You're always... Okay, the explode type. Yeah. The other behavior is, oh, it's all my fault. They're pointing out my faults. It's all my fault. I know it. I did this. You know, so it's blame ourselves, or along with blame ourselves, it's really all my fault, but they also did these mean things to us. But if I stand up to them, you know, and tell them, then they're going to get even madder, and I'm afraid of them. And besides, I've been socialized, especially for women, I've been socialized as a woman, and, you know, what do they call a woman who calls out any harassment or mistreatment? You got it. Yeah, I don't want people to call me that. So I'm going to go away and turn the icy shoulder towards that person. Withdraw into my room. Feel sorry for myself. And especially if it's somebody that we're close to, who's the other person, wait for them to come, you know, because we just, you know, dissolved and isolated ourselves, and we're waiting for them to come. And they say, dear, you seem angry. What's wrong? I'm not angry. Yeah, and we refuse to communicate. Yeah, that's how we retaliate. They don't get the pleasure of our company because we withdraw. And we let them know that it's their fault, even if at the same time we're also blaming ourselves. We let them know that if I'm blaming myself because, and I'm miserable because of blaming myself, it's your fault that I'm doing that. Okay? We usually implode or explode. Yeah. Imploders. Exploders. People who do both, depending on. Okay. So, you know, the ability to remain steady when people criticize us. It's an important ability. So how do we remain steady? Okay, instead of telling ourselves that whole story that I just went through, okay, there's a few other ways we can describe the situation to ourselves, okay? One is, okay, that person gave me some feedback that I wasn't asking for or expecting. Is it true? What they said, is it true? Okay, so there's only two possible answers to that, yes and no. Okay, so if it's true what they said, and I did make that mistake, and I do have that fault, then why don't I just say, you know, you're right? Because they're seeing it. Yeah. It's like they're looking at me and saying, you know, children, you have a nose on your face. What am I going to do? Say, no, I don't. Yeah. If I made a mistake, if I have a fault, and I know it, and they see it, why don't I just acknowledge it? It's in plain sight. And if I acknowledge it, it solves the problem right then and there. Yeah, you know, you're right, I made that mistake. Yep, I do have that fault. I'm working at it, but I do have that fault. Okay. And anyway, we're always saying we want to grow and improve ourselves. So here's somebody telling us how to do that. Why are we getting mad at them? Yeah, because we want them to come and make three prostrations and kneel down and say, dear perfect one, I want to point out a small little error in your ways. Please, may I do that? And then we will say, okay. And then they can point out the fault. But, you know, that's kind of takes a lot of time. So they just tell us directly. But if it's true, why not say it's true? And if it's not true, why are we getting mad? Yeah, if somebody criticizes us about something or blames us about something that we didn't do, why do we get so angry? Because you mean they're misinformed, so why get angry at somebody who's misinformed? Yeah, we may need to go and correct the information they have or whatever, but why are we angry? It's like somebody saying, you have flowers growing out of your head. No. No flowers growing out of my head. No horns growing out of my head either. So somebody who tells me I have those is misinformed. I don't need to get mad at them. Okay, that's one way to deal with criticism. Yeah, that's quite good. Yeah. Another way that I find very effective is, you know, because I'm usually like this with criticism. I don't like it. They say, very good, I'm getting criticized. Because I'm kind of full of myself and arrogant anyway. And this is like, you know, going to put my feet down on the floor. So it's actually quite good that they're criticizing me. This is quite helpful to my Dharma practice. Yeah? As soon as I look at the situation that way, anger's gone. Or another way I do it is I look at the person and it's like, okay, what's going on with this person? You know, they're unhappy and they think that by pointing out my faults or treating me like this, it's going to free them of their own unhappiness. It's not, but they think it will. Why do I need to get angry at somebody who's so confused like that? Yeah? Basically, what they're doing is creating negative karma. It's not going to benefit them at all. no reason for me to get mad at them. Rather, compassion for somebody else who's suffering would be much more useful. And that compassion doesn't mean that what they did to us is okay. It just means we're stopping our anger and, you know, tuning in to their unhappiness and wishing them to be free of that their unhappiness. So there's many, many different methods for dealing with anger in these kinds of situations. And I recommend you to His Holiness the Dalai Lama's book, Healing Anger, and my book, Working with Anger, which I freely admit is a plagiarized book. Okay, totally plagiarized. Shantideva, but he's from the 8th century, so he's not taking me to court. But the whole book is coming out of chapter 6 of his text, Engaging in the Bodhisattva's Deeds. And there, you know, training our mind to look at the situation in another way can be quite challenging. But as we train ourselves to do that, then our whole perspective changes. Okay, so that's the first kind of fortitude, dealing with the anger that wants to retaliate. Okay, so like I said, when we're free of that anger, then we can think creatively of what a response is. Usually when somebody attacks us, our first thing is thought is, what do I do? And we may go to our friends and say, what do? Somebody said this about me, you know. And I always say, don't worry about what to do. First, you know, work with your mind and free your mind of the anger. When your mind is free of the anger, then you can look at the situation and think, what is a good way to handle it? Yeah. But when we're angry, we usually don't think very clearly. And so the way we handle situations usually turns out to be a slippery slope. Yeah, that makes things worse for us. Okay, let me pause here before we go on to the second kind of fortitude questions or comments about this.
English is not my mother tongue, so I'm wondering, is there any difference between retaliation and revenge, for example?
Between what and what?
Retaliation. So what does it mean exactly? Is there any
retaliation?
Difference? Yeah. And revenge.
And revenge. They mean pretty much the same thing. Revenge has a connotation of a little bit more, you know, I'm going to get you. You know, retaliation is you slap the person. Revenge is you, you know. Yeah, at least that's the way I think of the connotation of the two words.
You mentioned the idea of ruminating on things, and I'm reminded that the root of the word for ruminate is for animals who chew their cud. The rumen is the stomach from which you cough this stuff up and re-chew it. And so sometimes as I am finding myself hashing over things again and again, I think about this cow sitting in a field just re-chewing the
chewing
same food
their
over.
Cud.
And then it really kind of pops me out of that frame of mind.
Yeah.
Good choice of words there.
Yeah. Let's go on to the second kind, which is the fortitude of enduring suffering. For example, illness, injury, difficult situations in general. Because you know, when we usually when we're sick, we, you know, many people get very angry. Yeah, why am I sick? Again, it's unfair. It's unfair that I'm sick. I shouldn't be sick. And if it's something contagious, it's somebody else's fault that I'm sick. They didn't cover their nose. They didn't wash the utensils. They, you know, always pointing the finger. Okay? Or if we're injured, you know, why am I injured? You know, you go skiing and you break your leg. You know, it's not my fault. It's, you know, the people who were in charge of the ski place didn't do something with the snow, and so as a result, I smashed into a tree. You know, it wasn't my poor skiing ability. You know, the tree moved in front of me by itself. You know, or the, you know, somebody else did something. But, you know, often when we have physical suffering, we're quite angry. Yeah? Or similarly with mental suffering, you know, if we're unhappy, we get about just anything. It's not even, people don't even have to do anything to us. Yeah? We wake up and we're in a bad mood. What's a bad mood? It's like low-grade anger, waiting for somebody to say hello so we can blow up at them, you know. So, you know, to have some ability to endure, you know, pain or endure situations that are not to our liking. And here I think of people who are political prisoners, yeah, who are incarcerated, and yeah, and they're angry. I mean, they're in a situation that they can't control, and they're locked up, and they don't know what's going to happen to them. And very, it would be very easy to get angry in that kind of situation, yeah. But to be able to remain, you know, steady and clear-sighted in that, or many other difficult situations that we find ourselves in because we cannot control everything that happens in our lives. Yeah. I can imagine, you know, some of the people who are refugees being angry. Now, why do I have to leave my home? Why do I have to leave my family? You know, why are these people dropping bombs, making it so that I can't live in my house? I don't wish them any harm. I didn't do anything to them. Yeah, and, you know, I could see refugees being really angry about their situation. Yeah, so all these kinds of things of suffering, how to have a calm mind, because for sure, in terms of bad health, illness and injury, unless we die first, illness and injury are going to come. Okay, you don't need to go to a fortune teller. Yeah, you'll pay a fortune teller to tell you that you're going to get sick. But I can tell you right now, and you don't have to pay anything, you know. I mean, the Buddha told us, it's the nature of our body. Yeah. And so how are we going to respond when illness and injury happen to our body? Are we going to freak out? Are we going to dissolve in self-pity? Are we going to get angry at the world? Are we going to refuse to see the situation? Are we going to be moody? Yeah. Or are we going to be able to say, well, I didn't have this on my calendar, but it's the reality of what I'm experiencing, and now this is how I practice the Dharma. Yeah, now my illness becomes the field in which I practice the Dharma. instead of, this wasn't supposed to happen to me. Like, okay, got to make a sharp right turn here and, you know, go a different direction, because I had my life all laid out this way and karma ripened and it's not going that way, it's going to go this way. So I better turn with it and adjust and learn how to make living with that illness or with that injury my Dharma practice. Once I was teaching in North Carolina, and this woman told a story when I was talking about this kind of thing. And she was a young woman, and she said that she had been feeling ill and gone to the doctor, and she had gotten, I forget what her diagnosis was, but it was some really bad disease. I mean, some chronic thing that after the end of a lot of suffering was going to be terminal. And when the doctor gave her this diagnosis, you know, how would you feel if you got that kind of diagnosis? Yeah. And so that's how she was feeling. And so she thought, well, what would the Dalai Lama do? Yeah. If the Dalai Lama were in this situation, what would he do? And the thought came in her mind, just be kind. You know, that's what His Holiness would do. All the doctors, the technicians, the nurses, the family, who's ever there, yeah, what's your Dharma practice? Just being kind to them. Just to be kind. Yeah, be a cooperative patient. Appreciate what other people are doing. Say things that will make their day a little bit better. Encourage them in their good qualities. And so she just made that determination. Okay, as long as I'm going to be sick, I'm just going to be kind to everybody. Yeah, and that just alleviated the internal anger and anguish. And as it turned out, later, they ran some more tests and they cleared that diagnosis. That wasn't what she had. And she was okay at the time she came to the course that I was doing. Yeah. So I thought, you know, that what she did was a really good way of, you know, okay, you know, my reality is not what I thought it was going to be, but this is how I'm going to practice and how I'm going to live in it. And just accepted it, you know, just be kind. And what a practice that can be. Also, when we're ill, it can be another technique to use is to realize this is the ripening of our own harmful karma that we've done. Yeah. This technique also works for the criticism and the beating and all the other things. It's to think, you know, this is the result of my own harmful karma. Now, sometimes when I say this, people say, it sounds like punishment. In Buddhism, do you have reward and punishment? My sickness is a punishment. No. You know, the Buddha is not God. The Buddha isn't punishing anybody. The Buddha is a compassionate being. If the Buddha could control the situation, we wouldn't be suffering at all. But the thing is that, you know, the Buddha may be omniscient, but is not omnipotent. And this situation is caused by my own harmful actions done in the past. Yeah. And my own harmful actions were done under the influence of my self-centered thought. So, you know, there's nobody else really to complain about or get mad at. You know, I'm just, you know, if you plant chili pepper seeds, you get chili peppers. And thinking that you're going to get daisies instead is your own wishful thinking. So I planted chili peppers. I'm getting this. Yeah. What did they say? You made your own bed, so lie in it. Yeah? So that kind of thing, you know? So if you don't like the bed, make it differently the next time. So in the same way, if I don't like the result of my own actions, then I need to improve my behavior and practice ethical conduct better rather than just doing whatever I want, creating all sorts of destructive karma. Yeah? And so thinking about it like that is very helpful, I find, you know, for alleviating a lot of the internal pain. And also thinking about karma in the sense of the karma I created that this is now a ripening of, you know, whatever action I did, who knows what in the world it was. You know, it could have been something from 15 million eons ago, some horrible action I did that actually could have ripened in my experiencing, many unfortunate rebirths for a long time. But now that karma is ripening in my getting sick right now in this life. Well, compared to having a whole lot of unfortunate rebirths for a long time, being sick is nothing. Yeah, I can handle being sick. It's certainly much better than that same karma ripening in a much, much worse way. Yeah. So by comparing it to how that karma could have ripened, then you realize, you know, even if we have a terminal disease, we can handle it. Yeah, we can actually handle it. We don't have to crumble and fall apart. Because whatever we're experiencing is certainly better than a whole lot of rebirths in the hell realm. Yeah. Anything's better than that. So I can handle this. Yeah. And then we start to see, oh, I have inner resources inside me. Yeah. I have inner resources, and there are resources in the community too. So, yeah, I can handle this. And then, you know, you regain your self-confidence and you go through it. Okay. The taking and giving meditation is also very effective for handling physical suffering. And also the suffering from when people insult us and everything. But I find it especially good for physical and mental suffering. Could be physical, could be mental suffering. To be able to say, as long as I'm experiencing this pain, may it suffice for the suffering of all other living beings. And then thinking of other living beings who have the same kind of illness, the same kind of injury, the same kind of unhappiness. And thinking, you know, may I take their suffering from them, yeah, and use it to destroy my own self-centeredness, my own self-grasping. And then may I take my own happiness from my body, from friends, body, possessions, and virtue. And may I give all those to other living beings so that they can have happiness. Yeah, so there's a much more detailed explanation about the taking and giving meditation. But it's very, very effective. Again, for strengthening the mind. And imagine taking on others' suffering. I can imagine giving them the things that bring me happiness. And then that often, again, it completely transforms our own mind. And it transforms the karma of the situation too. Yeah. Whereas, if we're sick or injured or unhappy or whatever, and we just get angry about it and stew in it and chew our cud, yeah, and say it's unfair and it's somebody else's fault, then we're really going to be pretty miserable, because then on top of the physical pain, we're going to have all this mental suffering also, which is often can be worse than the physical pain. Okay. And then the third kind of fortitude is the fortitude to practice the Dharma. You say, fortitude to practice the Dharma? Well, yeah, sometimes practicing the Dharma can be difficult. Yeah. Sometimes just to get to teachings, you have to overcome different physical inconveniences or suffering or whatever to get to teachings, or to do retreat, yeah, or to live in a monastery, Because, our life, sufferings come just, this is the nature of samsara. And to say, well, I can't practice the Dharma until all my suffering goes away. Yeah. No, then we're never going to practice. Okay. So again, it's learning to have a strong mind. It's like, okay, it's going to take some inner strength. When we have to train our mind in a new way of thinking, when we have to break the habit of blaming other people for our problems, it's difficult. Yeah, because we have a very strong habit. Yeah, my anger is somebody else's fault. Yeah. It's their fault. They did this. And we blame. Yeah. And breaking that habit of blaming others can be very, very difficult for us. And breaking the habit of blaming ourselves can also be difficult. Yeah. Because we're so used to blaming ourselves. Can't blame others, so hate myself instead. Both of them are rather stupid. But we have very deep habits, and so it can be very uncomfortable in our mind breaking some of these old dysfunctional emotional habits. Yeah, because we've done them so often that they're familiar, so they're comfortable in that painful way. Okay. Somebody I knew who suffered from depression told me, there's something very comforting in being depressed because you know what tomorrow's going to be like. Wow, I thought, what kind of suffering is that? Yeah. But when we try and break those habits like that of saying, I'm an angry person, I'm a depressed person, I'm a stupid person, I'm an unhappy, an inadequate person, whatever it is, breaking a lot of those habits of our identities and how we talk to ourselves and how our emotional patterns and all, it can be difficult, and so we need a lot of fortitude to be able to do that. When we start meditating on emptiness, similarly, yeah, over the weekend we're going to be having teachings on emptiness. When you really get into the teachings on emptiness, it shakes inside, yeah. When you don't really get into them, then it all makes perfect sense and it's fine, no problem. Yeah, Yeah, nothing really. You say, what's this big deal? Yeah, I'm dependent. You know, I'm not inherently existent. I can't find myself when I look. No problem. You know? Yeah. So that doesn't require any fortitude, because that's all, you know, conceptual blah blah up in our head. But when you really start to kind of question some of these identities and, you know, who we think we are, it can get a little bit uncomfortable there. Okay? Kind of like, well, if I'm not that, then who am I? What am I? So, again, developing that fortitude to be able to continue practicing. Or you're practicing the Dharma and your teacher and your Dharma friends come and say, you know, you're behaving in a way that's opposite to the Dharma. Oh, my teacher and my Dharma friends. You know. Yeah, you need to be able to take that, you know, and see that it's said in kindness and use it as something valuable. Okay? Yeah, put that one in big letters in your computer, okay? Yeah? Okay, so questions, comments?
Yeah, I do notice that I'm hesitant to say anything because anger has been really present for me, and it's embarrassing. And the thing that I find so discouraging is just walking right into it over and over again. Just, you know, 1 minute I'm fine, next minute, boom, you know. Whether I express it or don't express it, the rumination starts. And, you know, when you're talking about our mental habits are really hard to break. Mm-hmm. Even if I go, well, Venerable Children says this, this, and this, and I immediately, so I go think about that for an instant, and then I go back to it, yeah, but, you know, and it just keeps back and back and back. You know, eventually it wears out, fortunately. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is tough stuff.
Yeah. But that's why they call it practice. Yeah? Yeah? Practice means you do it again and again and again and again. Yeah. That's why it's called practice. And over time, it gets better. Wouldn't you say that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You're not as angry as you used to be. So it's getting better. So that's good. Rejoice.
You're talking about how we get angry in response to the story that we tell. But actually, I find it's the story comes later. The story keeps the anger going.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an initial flash, that initial feeling comes before the actual story gets going.
Yeah. It's actually, there is... It seems that way, but actually there's some story before that. There's, you know, this is an unpleasant feeling, I don't like it, you're the cause. And then we get angry, and then we start the creative writing course and write the novel, okay? But there's some initial thought of, you know, there's an unpleasant feeling and a rejection of that unpleasant feeling.
Yeah, the initial flash of anger mm-hmm. usually isn't in response to this elaborate story, but there's just a very simple, there's a perception, there's a seeing of the situation, but it's not really, I don't really have a detailed rumination going on.
Yeah, here. Yeah.
The storytelling comes later, and that keeps it going.
Right.
If I can catch the initial flash, say, that's the object to be negated. Your block of wood, whatever works. It can fade faster.
Yeah.
But the story keeps it going.
Right. Story keeps it going. Like I said, I think there's a short story before that. But it's always the case, if you're able to catch the anger sooner, it's easier to release it. Because the more we tell ourselves the story, the more we feel justified. Yeah.
I'm wondering about the connection between developing fortitude to practice the Dharma and how doubt mixes in there. Or doubt.
Explain better. What do you mean?
So it seems like oftentimes one of the obstacles to practicing the Dharma ends up being our doubt, our doubting mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so just to talk a little bit about how those two don't work together, you know, how doubt is really can pull you away from your practice, from your fortitude practicing the Dharma.
Mm. You mean like something bad happens, you're trying to practice fortitude, and then your mind starts doubting, well, why should I practice this? Does it really work? You know, this person's going to step all over me anyway, so I should punch him in the nose and just be done with it. Yeah, so that kind of doubt. Okay, so I think opposing that, it means looking. And this is where analytical meditation is so important, is really looking inside. And we've done all these other things before in response to what somebody's done. And then you just say, okay, I've done that before. Where's it led? Has it really solved the problem? Or here I am getting angry. You know, and the doubt comes, well, if I'm not angry, they're going to step all over me. Then you check that out. Is that true? Yeah? That if I practice fortitude, they're going to step all over me. Yeah, then you look. Martin Luther King practiced fortitude. They didn't step all over him. Yeah, Dalai Lama practiced fortitude. They didn't step all over him either. Yeah. Yasser Arafat didn't practice fortitude, and a lot of people got killed. So, you know, you just do some reflection and you see, you check it out for yourself. Use your own life experience and what you've learned to see, to check out your doubts, to see if your doubts are true or not.
So this probably goes under non-retaliation, but you know, you focused on the individual kind of response, but I also think of the societal lot you were born in. So fortitude around maybe you were born in a climate that's really harsh, or fortitude where you're born in a climate where you have no food or very minimal food, or your parents aren't the kind of parents that you probably would love to have. So I think that there's that kind of fortitude too, and it's not quite non-retaliation. I suppose you could feel like you need to retaliate against society in general, like this wasn't fair, I was born in this environment. But I was just thinking that's I think another really category for fortitude.
It could be part of the second one, the fortitude of just enduring suffering.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like illness, yeah. But not so much not physical, but more mental.
Yeah. It can be mental too, you know. I was born in this difficult situation, and there's not a way out of it. So I have to, you know, I have to find a way to make it meaningful.
Right.
Yeah, find a way to make my mind happy in this situation. Because we basically have two choices. When life isn't the way we want, we can be unhappy or we can be happy. Yeah? And which one we are depends on how we choose to look at the situation and whether we're able to apply our Dharma practice to that situation or not. If we can't apply our practice, we're going to be unhappy. If we can apply our practice, we can be happy. Yeah. If we can't apply our practice, but we're waiting for somebody to save us, you know, we're going to be unhappy for a long time. Yeah. Unless situations change very quickly. So this is the whole beauty about Dharma practice, is we can use it to change our own experience. So that instead of seeing a situation as, you know, this is a horrible situation and I have absolutely no choice of how to feel in it, to realize that there is a choice and we can see the situation in a different way. If we decide to, if we choose to.
In regards to the first fortitude that you were talking about, non-retaliation, mm-hmm. For me, I'm very new into Dharma, and it's very difficult for me to, if somebody does something to me, it's very difficult for me to let it go. If I do let it go, it's something I continually think about, and I think, you know, why didn't you do something? You're a chump. You're letting these people do whatever, X, Y, and Z. What are some techniques that I can not retaliate to people, but still feel good about, you know, still feel good inside, or try to alleviate those feelings when somebody does do something and I don't do anything back?
Yeah. So it's the whole thing of learning to subdue your own anger. Yeah. And so some of those things that I talked about as techniques to, or ways of seeing the situation, if you practice them again and again, your mind begins to change. At the beginning, you know, when you start practicing, you're usually riled up big time. And then once you're riled up, it's really difficult to calm the mind down. But you work at it. Then the trick is, when you're not angry, to think of things that happened in the past and apply some of these new ways of looking at that situation so that you wouldn't get angry if that kind of situation happened again. Sometimes when you're doing this, you may realize that you still have some leftover anger from that situation, that you thought you had let it go, but now when you're trying to apply a new way of seeing it, you realize you're still stuck in the anger. But you work at it. You know, it's really, it's difficult at first to get the mind to see the situation in another way so that we can release the anger. But the thing is, the more we practice something, the easier it gets. That's the good news. So if we practice again and again and again, our mind begins to shift to the extent that we adopt this new way of seeing things so that when a situation happens, immediately we see it in a different perspective and we don't get angry at all. But it's going to take a while of practice to get ourselves to that different stage. I know for myself, you know, there was one point in my life where I was really quite angry, my whole sob story. You're new at the Abbey, you haven't heard my Sam story. Oh, but I'm not going to tell you now because it's too late. but anyway... there was this whole conflict with somebody, and I went into retreat afterwards, and like every session I was doing, I was thinking about what happened and, you know, getting so furious and then, you know, practicing these techniques, getting myself calmed down, you know. So by the end of the session, okay, you know, it's fine. Get up from the session, fine. after a few minutes or by the time I sit down by the next session, anger again. And then having to again practice, you know, this thing and change my mind and look at it in a different way. It was a difficult retreat. Yeah, but, you know, again, I had two choices. I could sit there and be angry all day during every single meditation session, or I could try to transform my mind. I had those two choices. So the second one seemed like a better choice. Yeah? And then slowly, you know, it became much easier to think in those different ways.